Okay, so I'll be talking about a possible way to get gravitational waves from accreting neutron stars by basically building mountains in their crusts. And my co-conspirators are Lars Bilston, who's not here today, and Kurt Kuttler, who is in Potsdam, Germany. So I can basically say whatever I want. Let me give away the punchline. Andrew Cumming talked about the measurements of spins of neutron stars in low-mass X-ray binaries in the very beginning of this workshop, but it looks like the overlap with the people who are here is maybe five people. So most of what his talk is on the web, and you can look at more of it. I'll just review the highlights of what the spin periods of neutron stars and low-mass X-ray binaries are, and the interesting coincidence is that even though those systems are continually accreting, none of those neutron stars are spinning anywhere near breakup of 1.5 kilohertz, and most of the spins are in the 300 to 600 hertz range, and I'll go through the various details of that. And that brings up an interesting point. When these systems are continuously accreting, something has to be halting their spin-up so that they don't spin up to kilohertz or kilohertz and a half. And that's where gravitational radiation comes in. One of a possible mechanism for halting that spin-up is to emit gravitational waves and get rid of that angular momentum. And most of the work that we did was to look at whether one could build a mountain in a neutron star crust to account for that, to generate enough gravitational waves. And so I'll try to convince you that it's plausible to do so. So what are the systems I'm going to be talking about? Well, X-ray binaries, as everything else in astronomy, comes in two kinds. There are high-mass X-ray binaries and low-mass X-ray binaries. And basically, they're distinguished by the mass of the companion that donates matter to a disk that then gets accreted onto a neutron star. And also, for us, the main difference is the apparent presence or absence of a magnetic field. So high-mass X-ray binaries seem to be strongly magnetic, and the way we know that, or the way we infer that, is their spins are really easy to measure. That is, there is modulation and persistent emission that you can identify as spin of the neutron star. Versus in low-mass X-ray binaries, measuring spins has proved quite elusive for a long time, apparently because of their low magnetism. So what are these systems? There are about 60 low-mass X-ray binaries known in the galaxy. They accrete at rather substantial rates, up to the Eddington rate, 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. They're rather bright X-ray sources. They're also quite old. That's known both from evolutionary considerations and from their scale height on the disk, for example. And given that they're old systems, one could just estimate what the spin-up time is. That is, given the accretion torque of gas arriving at a Keplerian velocity on the surface of the star, how long will it take to spin up the neutron star to say 100 hertz, and it only takes 10 to the 7 years. So in 10 to the 9 years, you could expect to spin up to a substantial frequency, and these systems are thought to be the progenitors of millisecond pulsars. However, in the simple version, there is nothing preventing them from spinning up to all the way to breakup.
So by 10 to the 9, you actually mean the age of the LMXB phase itself,
yeah.
Not the whole system.
Yeah.
Is this a 10 to 9?
What?
I thought it was more like 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7.
No, I thought this is from White. This is from looking at their scale, at the distribution of the galaxy.
Maybe the lifetime of the donut mass extra time.
From just the cre from yes, just from the just comes about.
I think the nine would make the birth bit problem even worse.
But I think that in order to reach this, the millisecond range, you need so such so a small amount of mass.
That's right.
You don't care. That's not just if you just go part. Up to break up, then you need a substantial amount.
Okay. So people have looked for a long time for modulation in square epsilon and the brightest elements be just taking the Fourier transform of the X-ray light and trying to demodulate, trying to search for orbital modulation and stuff. And the limit, the best limit right now is 1%, is that the persistent modulation and persistent emission is less than 1%. That dates back to 1994. However, a couple of years ago, Rudy Weirens and Mikhail Vanderkleese found serendipitously the first system where you do see a strong modulation and persistent emission that can only be attributed to a neutron star spin. And so this is the first system that is clearly that has clearly millisecond spin and is and is still accreting. For the rest of these guys, measuring the spin is very difficult, and there's progressively less and less convincing evidence for spins.
Is there evidence for the field strength?
What?
Is there evidence for the field strength
in this one?
Yeah.
Well, from just assuming that the magnetosphere from the magnetosphere is outside the star, you get something like 10 to the 8 Gauss, as far as I understand. So
could be less.
Yeah.
Because all you need is a little in the material of the surface. The modulation is not that strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but for the rest of them, basically what you do is you look. So here's a light curve. What happens is you accrete, and here is some baseline luminosity due to accretion. And after you accrete an unstable pile of hydrogen and helium, it ignites, and you get the thing called an X-ray burst with a very fast rise and a slow, roughly 10-second, this is more like 20-second decline. And during this X-ray burst, you cannot expect it to the entire neutron star surface to blow up at exactly the same instant. What you expect is one spot to ignite first, and then the burning to spread. And while the burning is spreading, there is a large brightness asymmetry on the star, and that's when you would expect to see the modulation due to the spin. And so this was first discovered by Todd Strohmeyer. So he took basically there was a Fourier transform of the light in the during the burst, and he basically sees a clear modulation at about 360 hertz that is interpreted as a neutron star spin. There is some structure in this, and that has to do with the motion of the burning layer. And if you want to know more details, look at Andrew's talk on the web, or just talk to him. Basically, one can restore this, one can demodulate this motion and restore the coherence. And basically, the only way to understand that is in terms of neutron star spin. So up to now, seven such systems were discovered. One of them was discovered just a few weeks ago. And there are two with a spin of 300 hertz, and four with a spin of 600 hertz. And so basically there are seven systems out of 60 that show this phenomenon. There's a third way, there's a less conclusive way of looking for a neutron star spin, which is called the kilohertz QPOs. So what is shown here is the Fourier transform of the X-ray light from SCO X1, and you see a lot of structure at low frequency, and that is what that is what was known for a long time as previous satellites, but only with XTE did could you go to high enough frequency to see these little bumps that are called kilohertz QPOs, and here they're blown up, so there are two peaks at the frequency of roughly the kilohertz, and the peculiar behavior that they show is as follows. There are two peaks that move together as the accretion rate changes, as the brightness of the source changes, these two peaks move together, and they keep constant, roughly constant separation. And historically, the separation is roughly 300 hertz in all the systems where these have been observed, and historically what happened was in one of the systems with these these oscillations during the burst that were at 300 hertz, that separation is almost exactly equal to the separation of the kilohertz QPO peaks, and there are two of the systems like that. Then there was one system, then in other systems, the separation is twice, the separation is half this frequency, and the original discovery that is the separation is equal to the frequency during the burst basically incited people to come up with the beat frequency model, where this high frequency is some frequency in the disk, and the low peak is its beat was the spin. So the separation is the spin of the neutron star, and that was nicely confirmed when in those two systems where that separation is indeed 300 hertz. But then the other systems came along where the separation is 600 hertz. So the story was that separation is twice the spin.
Best frequencies seen in those sources? Are best frequencies seen in 600 hertz sources?
So in the sources where the burst frequency is 600 hertz.
Now, well, there's two things, right? There's the oscillations right. That you see in the burst, and then there's the separation.
Right. So this
you say there are systems in which the oscillations of the burst match that separation.
Yes.
In systems where the separation is twice that frequency,
right.
Are there oscillations in those systems which are 600 hertz or 300 hertz?
The oscillations in those systems are 600 hertz.
But not in QPO.
Not the QPO. So maybe this will make it well. So maybe this will make it more clear. So here's the summary. So the blue. So this is the spin. This is the neutron star spin. So the blue guys are all the kilohertz QPOs.
The separation.
Yeah, this is the separation of the kilohertz QPOs. There are two systems that have roughly 300 hertz spins, and these guys also have kilohertz QPOs at 300 hertz. Okay. Now there's one system. There are four systems with roughly 550 or 600
hertz. Those also correspond to quantum.
No, these guys don't. Only these two guys do.
Okay. So
the burst QPO is at 600 hertz. It has a kilohertz QPO at 300 hertz, and the funniest thing is that if you try to demodulate, so here's, this is work by Cole Miller, if you try to use the frequency of the main, so this is the burst QPO frequency, and here what Miller did is he demodulated the signal to try to combine as much power into one bin as possible and use that as a clock to try to coherently add the power in other bins. And so what he sees is a modulation of half this frequency. And so what he interprets this as the true spin and this as a second harmonic that's for some reason much stronger than the initial spin, but then this frequency agrees with the kilohertz QPO frequency, right? So that's the long story.
Frequency separation.
Yeah, kilohertz QPO frequency separation, I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
Well, so if you include a couple of millisecond pulsars with 600 hertz spin, mm-hmm. then there may be a bit of bimodal distribution.
Yeah. So another thing that I should add is people have looked at another source that shows these burst QPOs, and they have not seen they presume that the burst frequency, if you presume that the burst frequency is a second harmonic, then they put limits, they put rather strong limits on the modulation at what would be the main spin frequency. So I think it's not yet clear what's going on. So, but the summary is basically this. So this guy could be 290 or 580, depending on what you like to believe. But the interesting thing is that the spins are indeed in a rather narrow range. Yeah.
What do you mean it could be 290?
So this is the source where Cole Miller did this funny adding of bursts, and he was able to find some excess power at half the main frequency, which you would then interpret as the, this is 4U1636, where, no, two,
it's 290N,
right? Well, but only one of them could be the spin.
Well, forget about the spin, there's power in both.
Yeah, so,
just to prove the point, right? So it is, there is 580, you can't say that it's not 580.
Right. But if you so, but it's a question of what frequency do you interpret as the spin of the neutron star?
I guess the point is that this one actually has power at 300 Hz, like those two other guys.
Right. Versus the other one, another one does not.
If you choose, you can bring either of those two bins.
But it's in both.
Okay. Now we're talking semantics. Let's.
I guess the real question is whether this peak is. Is real, this peak at 290 Hz is real, whether it's just some fluke of data or not, because it hasn't been reproduced in any other attempts. Yes, from the even bursts from the same source, it hasn't been seen. Other people have looked.
Okay.
Is the twin burst loose picture change?
Yeah. But did they reanalyze also these data?
Yeah, this data has been reanalyzed, and whatever was done is done correctly.
So actually, in this data, he analyzed 5 bursts, and there's a single burst from this source which shows this peak at 290 Hz, but that's the only burst from this source, and all of the bursts of Shell oscillation show 500 Hz. So it hasn't been reproduced. So it's a question whether you can really believe that.
Yeah, and also the height of this burst is. So the noise level, I think, is roughly here. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a certain amount of selection going on here, so you don't know what the significance of this is.
Yeah. Well,
but is there any opposite case in the sense that you have bursts with the 300, say, hertz, and by analyzing that very carefully, you may see some overtone at twice the frequency?
Yeah. So this is for this KS1731. There is 2 sigma evidence for some modulation at twice the frequency.
So there are cases with two.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's a 2. So again, somebody another object with a spin of roughly 500. There's 2 sigma evidence for a peak at 1,000. Okay, and there's no evidence for a peak at 250.
Yeah. Okay.
So some people would say, well, the spin's 500, and we're seeing slight evidence for 1,000. In another object, someone says this: there's a big peak of 500, and slight evidence for 250. It's really not clear, but the main point is that you do see very coherent, strong oscillations of 500 Hz.
I think you have to be careful.
In all these books,
it could be just statistics. I think the most worrying thing is that just spins vary from 200 to 600 Hz, and we used to see an odd distribution by chance.
I mean, the complication in all this is the kilohertz QPO separation. So there are people who want that separation to be the spin.
Yeah,
and the separation is always roughly 300. So in the objects that receive 500 Hz spin, people would like that to be 250. So that's the motivation.
But I think also there are sources in which the separation is not constant.
Yeah, exactly.
The whole picture that this difference is the spin.
There's definitely a certain amount of belief. There's, for example, the analysis for 1728. So this is the source where the spin, so the burst PPO is at 360 hertz. There's no funny business with a factor of two, but this is the kilohertz QPO separation as a function of the accretion rate. So maybe it levels off. Maybe it still knows about this. Maybe it's just coincidence. Who knows? You're smiling.
Well, I think I remember that Bridgestead and Mario Vieti had the nice explanation of this trend, this change. In terms of the general relativity effects, or so.
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't believe.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's maybe it's a different approach.
Yeah. So let me.
So to within a factor of two, we know the spin.
Right.
So one other question: the LMXBs that have been examined, in, there has been no burst. I mean, there have been bursts, but there has been no burst frequency detected. Does that correspond to the rest of the set, or is that?
So there are 60, or roughly 60 altogether. For 20, so for 7, there have been bursts with the frequency detected. For about another 15, there is just the kilohertz QPO separation. So I think altogether there are about 20 for which there is some evidence for spin, and another 40 for which we just don't know. So that's the numbers. So, how could you understand these spins? Well, one possibility is in terms of just the standard Gaussian lamp type accretion mediated by the magnetosphere, where you basically reach a spin equilibrium, reach an equilibrium where the co-rotation radius is equal to the magnetospheric radius, and that gives you the equilibrium spin in terms of the accretion rate and the magnetic field. In this case, this is 10 to the 12 Gauss field, and so if you could say that you could just scale this field down and get the right spin, but just the fact that people have looked hard for the modulation and persistent emission and haven't really found it and had to go through all these hoops to even get some evidence for spins means that these systems are just not as magnetic as would be required for this model. Here's another illustration of this. So here, as a function of the accretion rate, I plotted the spin periods of accreting extra pulsars. I took this data for a bunch of them for some kind of a review from the review. And so here, you take the accretion rate and the spin, you calculate the magnetic field, and just these sources are more magnetic than these. And for these guys, it actually the field that you infer from cyclotron line observations actually agrees roughly with the field you would infer from the spin and the accretion rate. And so this picture is consistent. On the other hand, for low mass X-ray binaries, they look completely different. Their spins basically lie in a rather narrow range, and that would require to have, if you were to build a magnetospheric equilibrium model, that would require the magnetic field to correlate with the accretion rate to get the spins within this narrow range. But also, and more importantly, you would have to be able to hide this magnetic field most of the time because you don't see it in persistent emission. It has to somehow appear only during bursts. So this certainly opens up room for other theories, I would say. And one possibility is, could you use gravitational radiation to hold the accretional spin-up? And this is not a new idea. It's been proposed in the 70s by Papalozzi and Pringle, and recently revived by Lars Bilson and Niels Andersen in the context of both mountains and neutron stars and R modes in the cores of neutron stars. But the idea is the same. That is, if you balance the accretion torque by emitting gravitational radiation, then the torque due to gravitational waves is a very strong function of the spin frequency. And so as the neutron star spins up, at some point you need to really increase the accretion rate to get a small increase in the spin. And can easily estimate what quadrupole moment the neutron star needs to have in order to balance accretion at, say, 300 hertz. And the quadrupole moment, you basically need to displace roughly 10 to the minus 8 solar masses of stuff at the radius of the neutron star to get this equilibrium. And there's an equivalent relation in terms of R modes, in terms of the R mode amplitude that I won't go into. You can then write down the neutron star spin frequency as a function of accretion rate in the quadrupole moment. And basically, you see that it depends very weakly on the accretion rate. And so for a large range of spin, for a large range of luminosities or accretion rates, you can have similar spin periods. If all the systems had exactly the same quadrupole moment, this would, of course, predict some relation between the spin and the accretion rate. So given the factor of two ambiguity in the spin, I don't know if you could argue whether that could rule it out outside or not, but it's a reasonable theory. Yes?
Compared to the model you were just mentioning, I mean,
right.
The dependence of the B field you need on M dot and on the spin isn't.
Yeah, isn't all that dependent.
It's softer.
Yes.
I mean, it's much harder than, mm-hmm. than what you have mm-hmm. here, right? So are you in the situation of having to fine tune the quadrupole in some similar way that to fine tune the dipole and the magnetic torque model?
Yeah, so I'll show that the quadrupole, if it's limited by the breaking strain, ends up being in the range of what's required. So that sort of sets a natural limit.
Right, but I mean, just in terms of the preparameters M dot and U spin, mm-hmm. it doesn't look to me that delta Q is more narrowly constrained for a particular M dot and
so let me show let me just press on, maybe that will answer your questions. Another interesting little calculation that one can do is given this equilibrium between accretion and radiating with gravitational waves, if you assume that all the luminosity comes from accretion, and if you assume that all angular momentum gets radiated away in gravitational waves, then you can relate the gravitational wave strain to the flux, that is, the distance to the source scales out. And you can actually estimate what the gravitational wave signal at the Earth would be just in terms of observables, in terms of the spin and say, the extra flux. And if you do that, you can actually plot this for a few sources. So the brightest extra source, COX1, would have a strain of about 2 by 10 to the minus 26. And the SACS J1808 millisecond X-ray pulsar would have a strain right about here. And here are a few other sources where I presumed either the kilohertz QPO separation or the frequency during the burst, and I've used the known X-ray flux to calculate the strain, and overplotted are the LIGO sensitivity curves. So this is the sensitivity curve presuming a 10 to the 7 second integration and presuming perfect knowledge of the phase of the signal. That is, presuming you could add up all the signal coherently. If this point is above the line, you would detect it at some significance. So for LIGO 1, it doesn't look hopeful. However, for LIGO 2, either in broadband configuration or in narrowband configuration, you could detect, if you knew the spin of score X1, you could detect it pretty well. You look puzzled. No?
What are the dashed and full narrow band?
So there's an issue with the accretion rate changing on short time scales, and that could throw off your knowledge of the spin frequency. So one can show that the signal for Skolik Swan would drift by one frequency bin because of the accretionary changes in about 2 weeks. So this line is the sensitivity for a 2 week integration rather than for a 10 to the 7 second integration. So, and for this kind of for this kind of integration, there is no ambiguity. At least with this, you know, was the frequency drifting because of the variations in the accretion rate. There is still ambiguity because of not knowing precisely the orbital parameters. So now I'll just talk about I'll talk about the actual mechanism of how one could possibly deform a neutron star crust and give rise to this quadrupole moment of roughly a few by 10 to the minus 8 solar masses displaced at the surface of the neutron star. So first of all, there is a big difference between crusts of newborn neutron stars and crusts of neutron stars in low-mass X-ray binaries. So in low-mass X-ray binaries, you can easily replace all of the neutron star crusts by accretion. And so the composition is not cold catalyzed matter, but it's the products of nuclear burning in the atmosphere that have then been put through this transfer function of having been compressed in the crust. And what happens in the crust is the following. So there's some element, imagine a fluid element, entering from above, and imagine it's made of pure iron, which is probably not the case, but as it gets compressed, the electron Fermi energy rises to the point where it becomes energetically favorable to capture an electron onto a nucleus and lower the charge of the nucleus by one. Actually, these captures come in pairs. So you actually capture one electron and then another electron. So you go from AZ to AZ minus two. And what happens in that during that capture is you change density because at least in the outer crust, electrons are providing all the pressure support. So if you eliminate electrons, you have to increase density to keep the pressure continuous. So the crust consists of layers, these onion shells, of different elements. And the crucial...
What happens to hydrogen? When accreting, what is hydrogen?
Okay, you accrete hydrogen way, way over there.
I see.
But then it burns.
Accumulating.
Right.
Goes all the way to the crust like 10 to the 9th. I think some of the accretion model like Hank is on neutron stars. It's not binary.
Mm-hmm.
So the M dot is very small. And still, I think they require, some of their models for actually magnetars, they require that the hydrogen will go all the way down to very deep.
But what is the accretion rate? What is
that? Much less than binaries, as I understand, for the kind of models they were using for magnetars.
Yeah, so for these guys,
even though it's much less than for even this low mass X-ray binaries. So, and they require hydrogen to get deep down to the crust at least like 10 to the 9, as I understood.
Really? Okay.
I just wonder, you have to look into those things.
So you
cannot have hydrogen in your model?
For these guys, as far as I understand, it all gets burned well before you get...
Because M dot is much less than those magnet models with hydrogen crust. So these are the
new binaries. No hydrogen can survive if density is higher than 10 to the 7 because of peak and nuclear burning.
So that's where I'm answering.
So far, the only calculation that I know of that follows a fluid element through compression and does these kind of non-equilibrium captures is a calculation by Hansel and Zdunik, and it was done for pure iron. And of course, so the elements that enter the top of the crust in low mass X-ray binaries are probably not, the products of burning are probably not pure iron. And so what somebody needs to do is a calculation for different kind of elemental mix that comes out of burning in the atmosphere. However, the picture is that you have these layers of different elements separated by by the places where you capture electrons. And in the inner crust, what happens is electron captures are followed by neutron emissions, just because there you could emit neutrons. And the point is that these reactions release energy. They release about, from going from the top of the crust to the core, you release about an MeV per accreted baryon, which is a substantial amount of heat in the crust. So basically, these layers have different densities. But if the situation is spherically symmetric, then that doesn't give rise to the quadrupole moment. So how could one deform them? So here as a function of depth into the star, so the surface is that way, the core is that way. I looked at the capture layer in an outer crust, where you go from calcium to something that has Z of 18, which I don't know what it is. So here's the abundance of calcium as a function of depth, and here's this capture layer. And the density jumps by a factor that's given just basically by the decrease of Z by 2. And so delta Z over Z is just 2 over Z, which is like 10% in this case. However, what happens with these structures, at high temperatures, the rate becomes very temperature sensitive, because instead of waiting until the electron Fermi energy gets to be equal to the mass difference between these two nuclei, you can use electrons on the thermal tail to capture. And then the reaction rate becomes temperature sensitive. So imagine here's the crust of the neutron star going from left to right, and the temperature on one side is a little bit higher than the temperature on the other side of the crust. Then if this is the unperturbed position of the capture layer, then on the hotter side, electrons will capture earlier, and on the colder side, electrons will capture later. So now the density jumps here by roughly 10%, and jumps higher, physically higher in the crust than here. So that does create a little mountain, and you can estimate what is the quadrupole moment due to this mountain. So it's basically just the mass, delta rho, times the area, and times r squared, times the radius squared. And the numbers that you get are in the ballpark of what's required. That is, you need to displace roughly 10 to the minus 8 mR squared for the temperature difference between the sides of 10 to the 8 degrees.
So between the
temperature difference between the hot side and the cold side. So on the hot side you capture higher, on the cold side you capture lower in the crust. And if this temperature difference is 10 to the 8 degrees for this naive estimate, and I'll go in and show a more.
What is the geometrical sizes you have in mind for these temperature gradients?
So what I would need is basically the temperature gradient over the length scale of the radius of the star. So literally one side hot, one side cold.
So Greg, when you say the hot side and cold side, you mean one side of the star is
cold? Yes.
And the other side.
Yes, so physically, so here's the star, here's the crust, and this side is hot, and this side is cold. So let me go into that in a second. But first, let me say where else I pulled the fast one on you. So here again is the situation. So this side of the star drawn as a plane parallel. A slab, this side of the crust is hot, this side of the crust is cold, so the density here is higher than here, but there's a transverse pressure gradient that goes from one side of the star to the other, and if this was a liquid, you basically couldn't sustain that. But the crust is a solid that has some shear modulus, which is basically given by the ratio of Coulomb energy density to the pressure, which is roughly 1%, so it's very soft, jello-like, but nevertheless it's a solid, and so one can support some kind of a deformation like that. The question is how much, and the question is whether the things will just shift around as you apply this loading, or they will like to sink.
So
And so we've done the complete calculation where we'll allow the crust to sink and move around and just ask, if I put in a certain temperature gradient, what happens to the capture layers, where do they go and how much do they sink, and what is the resulting quadrupole, what is the resulting delta rho. Okay, the second.
So this is, you let the crust deform up to its maximum strength, so to speak, and then when it's more than that, you let mass flow horizontally.
Well, we haven't done anything about plastic flow. We compare. There are two calculations. One calculation is in terms of the temperature difference, or actually not in terms of the temperature difference, but I'll go into this in just a minute. But there is one calculation in terms of the temperature difference. Another calculation, just in terms of the maximum strain that you can support. You could ask, if the stuff breaks when I apply some strain, what is the quadrupole moment that I could build by doing it absolutely efficiently? And then the real quadrupole moment would be somewhat less, but you can at least put an upper bound. Okay. So how can one create a temperature gradient in the crust? And the other related question is, the crust, which has small finite conductivity, sits on top of a perfectly conducting core. So one may worry that even if you could say it would take a lot to maintain that temperature gradient. But in these accreting neutron stars, here's what happens in the crust. So here's the core of the star, here's the density, here's the core of the star, here's the surface. Accretion and all that energy release on the surface of the star happens somewhere here, but basically none of it goes inside the star. All of it leaves off the surface. However, you heat the reactions, these electron capture and neutron emission reactions in the crust release this MeV of heat per accreted baryon, and that is what's heating the crust and the core of the star. So there is some of it. So the temperature, unlike a cooling neutron star, where the temperature would basically look like this, would be isothermal in the core, and then it would be cooling otherwise. In a cooling neutron star, there is actually a hump in temperature, roughly around neutron drift. So some of the heat goes into the core, some of the heat goes outside.
You treat it cooling before?
Yes. Yeah, that's what decreases. Yeah.
If I
had the young too. Right. So basically, if the composition, that is the actual elements comprising the difference of the star, different size of the star are different, then the transport coefficients depend on z squared over a. Both the conductivity depends on this and the neutrino emissivity. So if I back up for a step and say that the different sides of the star are made out of different stuff, then this heat flux through the star will be modulated on different sides of the star because the heat is more difficult for heat to flow out on the star on the side with higher z squared over a than on the side with lower z squared over a. So I can parametrize. So if I put in a composition asymmetry, that is, if I say that this quantity is different, varies laterally, then I can calculate the temperature gradient self-consistently. Okay? So this is basically invoking a tooth fairy. But at least what I can say is that I can calculate, I can ask how inhomogeneous does a neutron star crust need to be in order to create a certain temperature gradient. And that calculation is then self-consistent. And so what I get is in order to generate a quadrupole moment that's enough to hold accretion, you need the different size of the star to be inhomogeneous by about 10%.
And the reason you cannot compute composition variation is because uncertainties in the conductivity?
Well, Then I would have to make some kind of a evolutionary story for a neutron star in a low-mass X-ray binary. So imagine at first, when it just started accreting, it started out with high magnetic field. So accretion of the child was channeled into the poles, and that naturally creates some kind of a seed asymmetry. But then as you're accreting longer and longer, you kill that magnetic field, you bury it, or do something with it that basically on the surface looks like a non-magnetic neutron star, but you've seeded that asymmetry, okay. And now you made the different size of the crust are indeed made of different stuff.
But couldn't you fairly naturally argue that there would be equatorial accretion?
Sure. But in order to radiate gravitational waves, you need that to be misaligned from an equator. Right. So without going to some long complicated story about how that neutron star came about, I basically can't say what is the composition gradient. But what I can say is that all I need is for a single capture layer to generate the relevant quadrupole moment, I need the composition asymmetry of 10%. For many capture layers in the neutron star crust, which is the case, you need the proportionally smaller asymmetry. So that's basically the upshot. So here's the quadrupole moment as a function of the position of the depth of the capture layer. So you in this plot in terms of the threshold energy. So this is deep in the crust. This is pretty much the bottom of the crust. This is the top of the crust. And this is presuming that this asymmetry in z squared over a is 10%. I can then calculate what is the temperature distribution in the crust by modulating this outgoing flux. And then calculate how capture layers deform, how they sink or shift around, and then calculate the quadrupole moment. And so what I get is in the deep crust, you indeed get, if you go in the deep crust, then a single capture layer can generate enough quadrupole moment to hold accretion, roughly 10 to the minus 8 of mr squared. So because these capture layers add up, basically more or less linearly, you need the proportionately smaller asymmetry.
How much reduction particle is there due to sinking?
So I didn't bring that plot, but basically at the top of the crust, there is a lot. There is a factor of about 20 to 50. At the bottom of the crust, there is about a factor of 10. So as you go in deep in the crust, first of all, the mass that you involve increases. And the penalty for sinking rather than just shifting around is about a factor of 10. And so consequently, that requires a rather small temperature asymmetry.
The top sinks more than
just because the crust stretches a little bit. And so you can imagine this asymmetry built, you can imagine this little spring, and I hang a little weight on it. And so it sinks, but it sinks a little bit, and that's what holds it up.
Is this factor basically delta R over R star?
Yes, in fact, more or less.
You see the factor of 10 or 10%?
What?
You get the factor of 10?
Yeah, in the inner crust, it's about a factor of 10, which is the thickness of the crust divided by the radius.
So the question was why deeper in the crust, you're saying it doesn't sink so much up?
The power is larger. All the sinking is done, by hydrostatic balancing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not assuming that the crustal strength supports it against.
Well, in the end, what happens is it sinks, but in the end, if the crust had no shear strength, it would not support it at all.
Well, I was just wondering whether you. The accreted matter is supposed to be supported by crustal strength or by hydrostatic pressure. In other words, just like Everest is supported not by the strength of the crust, but just by buoyancy,
mm-hmm.
It's only horizontal imbalance that counts. It's, in your calculations, it's only the horizontal balance, isn't it?
So in this case, it's just the strength. It's not the buoyancy, it's just the strength that supports it. And I can actually show that. I can actually, let me go through that and show that. So I'm allowed to show some equations because this is Institute for Theoretical Physics. So from intuition, if you have a perfect fit, you could not have a quadrupole moment. But you can actually show that, you can actually just demonstrate that. So if you write the shear stress tensor as the pressure piece, this should be a GAB over here, plus a shear strain piece, and then write down hydrostatic balance, which is just the divergence of the stress tensor, is equal to delta rho g, then basically you put the radial equation would just reduce to hydrostatic balance, to the usual hydrostatic balance if you didn't have shear stress. And then the transverse equation is what gives you the asymmetry. But from the transverse equation, you can just compute what the pressure perturbation is and then eliminate it from this equation. And then you can compute delta rho and integrate it over the star. And so you can basically just write down the quadrupole moment as this integral over the shear stresses with some prefactors. Okay, and then each of the shear stresses is basically strain, is basically shear modulus times some strain. So if you assume that you optimally strain the neutron star, that is the strains are everywhere near the maximum strain that it can support, then you can just evaluate these prefactors, and you can then compute the optimal, so to speak, quadrupole moment set by the breaking strain, and this is what it looks like. So it's basically just shear modulus. So this is the fact, this is 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3 in the crust, times the breaking strain, times the moment of inertia in the crust, times this factor of delta R over R that Chris was talking about. So basically, so the maximum quadrupole moment that you can support by pressure and shear modulus forces only, that is without looking at magnetic field, is for a 10 kilometer, 1.4 solar mass neutron star, is roughly, 10 to the minus 7 of MR squared. And it does go very strongly with the radius of the star, and it does depend on the composition at the bottom of the crust. So this basically shows, and this is roughly the quadrupole moment that one needs to understand the spin to balance accretion of at the Eddington rate with gravitational wave emission. So it basically says to understand SCOREX1 in terms of this balance, you need to be radiating, you need to strain the neutron star crust basically to breaking.
How this break strain can be compared with that of normal young neutron stars, cooling neutron stars? In the sense, my question is going to, in the case of neutron stars, in pulsars, we do see bleaches. Mm-hmm. In this case, could you expect some sudden release that can be seen as a bleach or not?
So, I don't know. See, what happens with terrestrial materials is when they're under high pressure, they don't like to crack. The pressure is much higher than the shear modulus. They really don't like to crack. They like to just deform plastically.
So it's always smooth.
So for these systems, they're being continually forced by accretion. So my guess is as good as any, but I wouldn't expect them to crack very often. I would expect them to just flow plastically.
In the Earth, however, deep focus earthquakes occur where the pressure is way above the shear modulus.
Yeah, so I don't know.
It finds a way to crack somehow.
Yeah, so I've been trying. I'm not going to say anything new about plastic deformation. Let me give my best shot as to what I understand about it. So basically, if you look at strain, that is the deformation versus stress of some slab of stuff, usually there is an elastic regime where stress is proportional to strain, that's just Hooke's law, But then, depending on the material, it either just breaks or it starts deforming plastically. That is, you bend it more and more and more, but you don't get any more stress out of it. And at least in geophysics, so what is important for these kind of, whether a material behaves elastically or plastically, is a time scale on which you perform the deformation. For example, if you take a slab of steel and you put a little ball bearing on top of that, it's going to make a small dent, but when you lift up the ball bearing, of course, the surface of that metal will be completely flat. However, if you leave that ball bearing for a million years, you're going to make a dent. So that's the plastic deformation. And so on timescales faster than the so-called Maxwell time, things behave elastically, versus on timescales longer than that, they behave plastically. And this Maxwell time is just the ratio of viscosity to shear modulus of the material. So for the Earth mantle, you can actually measure this experimentally. The way it's measured is from glacial uplift. That is, in Scandinavia, there was a big mountainous plateau, and then during the Ice Age, that got loaded with an ice sheet, so it actually got depressed into the core. And after the ice sheet melted, you can actually now observe the uplift, that is the slow rising of the surface. And you can count, and it's roughly, the time scale for that is roughly 10 to the 4 years. So what could it be for a neutron star crust? Well, who knows? That hinges on how to get viscosity for a Coulomb solid. So if you imagine straining a Coulomb lattice, how would it relieve the stress? Well, if there are some imperfections or vacancies, they would hop. And basically, that rate could determine the rate of the stress relief. And so, but all these hops are thermally activated. So there is some activity. They go as e to the activation energy over kt. And the only kind of energy scale in that Coulomb lattice is basically the Coulomb interaction energy. So the ratio is roughly gamma, the Coulomb energy over kT, which deep in the neutron star is like 1,000 or 2,000. So you can actually, there's a cute way of writing down the Maxwell time. So it's 1 over the shear modulus times the ratio of the area of the grain, the area of the size of this little crystal, divided by the internuclear spacing and divided by the sound speed. But then there's this factor of e to the gamma. And so if this factor is e to the 2,000, then you can take the grain size to be an internuclear spacing divided by the sound speed, or divided by the speed of light, or whatever you want, and you still get something much bigger than any kind of relevant time. So this kind of naive estimate, at least to me, and please shoot me down, this tells me that it's always elastic.
But your particle is constant in your neutron drift.
And you're at the bottom of the crust, actually.
The
yeah. So on the other hand, if I... Yeah, go ahead.
What if you just take the viscosity estimate from something like Tatla?
Yeah, so that's the next thing. So if you just take ordinary microscopic viscosity,
yes.
Right, then you basically get something like 20 minus 10 seconds. That is, it's always a liquid. Even if you take a ridiculous turbulent viscosity, imagine somehow that this is turbulent, you still get 10 to minus 4 seconds at the bottom of the crust. So
the opposite.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know.
But it's not a liquid. It's
no, I mean this kind of estimate presumes it's a liquid. So but it's not a liquid. So I mean, there's nothing deep in that. It's just trying to understand whether, you know, what are the relevant scales.
The deeper layer of the crust are like liquid crystal. The deepest layer of the crust are liquid crystal. Spaghetti, lasagna,
flavor. Right, but that just means that the shear modulus is anisotropic. Right. That just means that for some sorts of strains. there is no restoring force, but for other sorts of strains, there is the same restoring force as always. But still, I don't think that changes the estimate for when you strain it, how fast does it relax. But I don't know. So I think I'm just going to stop here.
Any further questions?
So if you try to complete this picture by figuring out a particular way in which these composition variations might arise in the first place, like whether the magnetic field within the equator or something, if you try to wrap it up in that way.
Yeah, so you'd make some kind of a story whether you started with a 10 and 12 Gauss field, were accreting magnetically for a little while, building up the seed asymmetry, but then the field decayed or you buried it or did something like that. But that seed asymmetry creates this temperature, this R scale temperature asymmetry, just because of the different composition and different size of the star. And then you can't wipe it out. Then you just basically propagate it all the way through the crust as you accrete more and more.
If you took these sort of compositional asymmetries and applied them to, say, the limited inertia of the Millis and pulsar, could you actually predict sort of the level of timing noise? Time constraint? Basically,
And so the temperature perturbation, the nice thing about temperature perturbations is once you stop forcing it, what I'm basically doing is I'm taking the radial heat flux that a neutron star has and modulating it by putting in some composition gradient. Once the heat flux goes away, once you stop accreting, this heating in the deep crust goes away, and so does the heat flux. And so those temperature perturbations get washed out, and basically the thermal time in the crust, so a few years.
But you don't have any compositional changes left?
But those don't contribute. You have to strain it with this thermal piece.
Did you say this is a mountain?
Yeah.
Well, so strictly speaking, it's 3D, isn't it?
Yeah, but what
you treat it as 1D.
Well, what I've done is expanded everything in YLMs.
But what you did, maybe more like a shell. You did it in 1D in radial direction, right?
So what I presumed is that the angular dependence of everything is a spherical harmonic.
So it doesn't delta, you think, the horizontal.
Well, so I can calculate the change in density as function of the scale, of the transverse length scale. And then if you want, if you give me a composition asymmetry that has a funny shape, I can always expand it in terms of spherical harmonics, and then...
So the other direction is not important,
you say. Right, so I presume that it's... Mm-hmm. Since all I did is a linear calculation, yeah. I can always expand things.
Yeah. What if you don't have temperature gradient, but just have composition gradient? Will you get a...
So the other way to think about this is the equation of state in the crust is not the same at different angular positions in the crust. So the pressure as function of density is just different, and so that gives you a transverse pressure gradient, and that deforms the crust. So yes, if you have a smooth composition gradient, that would also strain the crust.
So you don't need a temperature.
But is that a bigger effect, the temperature pieces are bigger?
They're comparable. So, yes.
Would this then mean that when you actually do shut off the operation, you will reduce the delta Q but only by a factor of 2?
So to completely wipe it out, you need to roughly accrete the amount of matter that's in capture layers. That, so you need to replace the capture layers by kind of a uniform, by uniform composition. So you need to accrete at 10 to the minus 9 solar masses per year. You need to accrete for 10 to the 5 years to replace the capture layers, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I'm interested in what happens when the accretion shuts off. Right. Will you still have a quadrupole?
Yes, you will have some.
So.
But if they're of comparable importance, then that quadrupole will still be complete. Like, the quadrupole is got with the accretion, but maybe half.
So you have millisecond pulses.
I guess the temperature gradient went away. Wouldn't the nuclear reaction simply reverse all the composition gradients, leaving you back with a non-uniform star?
Well, no, because reverse reactions are blocked in all of these capture layers. So you can't actually reverse it. You have to, well, the position of the capture layer would shift.
So that Q wouldn't remain then in the millisecond pulsars, and they would be spinning down at a certain rate, which may be higher than their observed.
Well, so you basically need to accrete enough matter to flush out the capture layers.
So you keep accreting, but with the temperature composition gone.
So basically the way to spin up a neutron star to a very fast rate would be to accrete transiently, where the temperature variation always dies away before the next accretion interval.
Okay.
Well, I guess one last comment, for it's worth the strain that you were analyzing to, based on. We're seeing the software computers may not be unusable, and giant flares have to store 44 Hertz. I mean, it's magnetic stress to make things move around, but it's hard to get around with limited strain, much less than that, and put enough energy into these flares. And you know, I think the problem of fracturing the crust is actually a subtle one, because unlike a metal plate, it's highly constrained. If you want to break a metal plate, you can pull it or you can shear it, but that involves a 3-dimensional motion. But the crust itself, if you want to break it over a very large scale, which is basically what you're assuming, that, I guess, a very low order of oil ions, that's very constrained. And it's not clear how easily one can just simply extrapolate them, the limiting strains one observes in crustal materials.
I was also trying to play the same game as you did for the magnetic field. That's why I was interested in your claim that for a large enough magnetic field in a magnetar, you just plastically deform the crust rather than break it. But I don't think you can make the same statement here. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks.